could not be overstated. He said, "Within our borders are thousands of mehablim, terrorists, and they had the support of the general Arab population, who at a minimum would give them succor and shelter. My first job was to increase Mossad's targeting and penetration of all Palestinian organizations." Meir Amit was told by Israel's new prime minister, Golda Meir, to devise a plan to get the completed boats out of France. He would recall, "First suggestion was we should sail into Cherbourg with sufficient armed sailors and just take the boats and head back for Israel." Moshe Dayan, then Minister of Defense, sat on that hard. He correctly pointed out that the international reaction would create huge repercussions and see Israel branded a thief. Whatever we did had to be done legally. We had to come up with a watertight right to sail out of French territorial waters. Once we were out on the high seas, it would be a different matter. The legality of what was to follow would be in the eyes of the beholder. Despite Dayan's insistence on the letter of the law being obeyed, what was contemplated was pure and simple trickery. By November 1969, Meir Amit had the first stage of Operation Noah's Ark in place. A London-based firm of lawyers had been briefed by Israel's largest shipping company, Maritime Fruit, which freighted produce around the world, to register a new firm named Starboat, after the Star of David. Its principal shareholder was Myla Brenner, a director of Maritime Fruit. The other shareholders were proxies for Meir Amit. The second part of the operation went equally smoothly. For months, Admiral Mordechai Limon, the Israeli Navy liaison officer at Cherbourg for the gunboat project, had been discussing compensation with the shipyard for breach of contract. Each time the French came close to an agreement, Limon had found a new point to argue. On November 10th, he informed the shipyard that Israel was once more ready to discuss the matter. In Tel Aviv, Myla Brenner had contacted one of the most respected shipping magnates of the world, Ole Martin Siem, based in Oslo. He agreed to join the board of Starboat for the specific purpose of purchasing the gunboats. Limon, with a sleight of hand worthy of a card player, made his move. On November 11, he met with shipyard officials. He listened to their improved offer of compensation and said he was still not satisfied. The officials were astonished. Their new offer was a generous one. While they contemplated what to do next, Limon hurried to Paris. Waiting there was Ole Siem. After the two men met, Limon telephoned the shipyard officials to say he would be in touch with them in a few days. Within the hour, Siem was seated in the office of General Louis Bonté, the French government's arms salesman. Siem said he had heard that there are some gunboats for sale that can be converted to drill for oil. Timing his intervention to perfection, Limon at that moment called Bonté to say he was in Paris and was ready to accept a final offer in compensation. The figure he proposed was the one the Cherbourg shipyard officials had offered. Bonté told Limon he was in negotiation and would call back. The general then turned to Siem and revealed the offer Limon had agreed to accept, but said it was too high for the government to agree to pay. Siem promptly increased Limon's offer by 5%. Bonté called back Limon and said his offer was most agreeable. Bonté believed he had made a good deal in ridding France of a thorny problem. Israel would get its compensation, and France would have made a 5% profit. He only had two questions for Ole Siem. Were the boats going to Norway? Could Siem guarantee they would not be re-exported after their oil exploration activities? Siem gave an unequivocal guarantee on both counts. Bonté accepted that to avoid press inquiries about the site of the oil fields, a sensitive commercial matter in an industry renowned for its secrecy, the removal of the boats from Cherbourg would be done discreetly. A departure date was set for Christmas Eve 1969, when Cherbourg would be celebrating the start of the holiday season. There was still a month to go, and Meir Amit was only too well aware that that was more than enough time for things to go wrong. There would be a need to provide 120 Israeli sailors to crew the boats for the 3,000-mile voyage from Cherbourg to Haifa. To send that many men at one time would most certainly alert the French security service. Once more, the inventive Meir Amit had the answer. He decided only two sailors at a time would travel together to cities all over Europe before going to Cherbourg. The sailors were instructed not to stay in the port's hotels for more than a night before moving to another one. They all traveled on Israeli passports so that in case they were caught, they could not be charged with possessing forged travel documents. Nevertheless, Mayor Amit knew the risks were still high. It just needed one suspicious French policeman to ask why so many Jews were coming to Cherbourg for Christmas, and the whole operation would be blown. By December 23, the sailors had all arrived in Cherbourg. Scattered around the town, they listened to the incessant carols. Some who had been born and raised in Jerusalem joined in the singing. In Tel Aviv, a relieved Mayor Amit watched other problems come and go. The question of providing enough supplies for 8 days at sea had been solved by the operations supply officer visiting every shop in Cherbourg. But whenever shopkeepers pressed on him Christmas jambon, he politely refused. The 250,000 liters of fuel had been smuggled on board in drums and hidden below decks. The one great imponderable was the weather. The boats would have to sail across the Bay of Biscay in winter conditions which could sink them. Mayor Amit would recall that in Tel Aviv, what we prayed for was Dunkirk weather. We had sent a meteorologist to Cherbourg, and he monitored every forecast out of England, France, in Cherbourg, and Spain. The hours ticked slowly by, until finally it was Christmas Eve. The forecast was for rain, gusting out of the southwest. Nevertheless, the order was given to sail at 8:30 that night. By 7:30 p.m., the crews were all on board, but the weather worsened. A new departure time was set for 10:30 p.m. That came and went, halted again by the weather. From Tel Aviv came urgent coded signals. Sail, no matter what the conditions. In Cherbourg, the ranking Israeli naval officer ignored the pressure. For him, the lives of his men were more important at that moment. In his command boat, he sat silently watching the meteorologist, feverishly studying his weather charts. At midnight, the weatherman announced, "The winds will drop and veer northerly in 2 hours. They will not be so strong and be behind us. We can go." At exactly 2:30 a.m. on Christmas Day, the boat's engines started and the crafts headed slowly out to sea. 7 days later, on New Year's Day, they sailed into Haifa Harbor. Among those waiting on the quayside was Mayor Amit. For him, the new year could not have had a better start. But he also knew President Charles de Gaulle would never forgive Israel for what had happened. On December 2, 1990, well to the south of Baghdad, a figure in the dirty robes of a desert dweller lay motionless just below the lip of a wadi. It was dawn and the sand ice cold. During the night, the temperature had dropped to well below zero. The man's head was covered with a sheep's wool hupta, a hat which identified him as a tribesman of the Sarami, the oldest of the Islami Sufi sects, who roamed the vast Iraqi desert and whose fanaticism was matched by a code of honor unequaled by the other tribes. But the man's loyalty lay some 600 miles to the west, in Israel. He was a Katza. His clothes came from a Mossad storeroom, where garments from all over the world were kept and regularly updated. Most were obtained by Sayanim and delivered to local Israeli embassies and sent on to Tel Aviv in diplomatic bags. A few were actually made by the wardrobe mistress who presided over the storeroom. Over the years, she and her small team of seamstresses had developed a reputation for detail, even using the right sewing cotton for adjustments. The Katza's code name, Shalom, came from a list of aliases kept on file in the operations division. Rafi Eitan had introduced the idea of a fist after the Eichmann operation. Shalom Weiss had been one of the best forgers in Mossad before he had joined the team to help capture Adolf Eichmann. Shalom Weiss had died of cancer in 1963, but his name lived on and had been used on several occasions by the Katzas. Only a handful of senior IDF officers, Shabtai Shavit, and Shalom's own section head knew why he was in the desert. Shabtai Shavit, displaying the caution of a new man in charge, had said that on what he had been told, to raise the alarm could only create needless panic. Shalom had been given the mission to discover the truth. He had carried out several previous operations in Iraq, once going on to Baghdad, where he had posed as a Jordanian businessman. Already fluent in Farsi and Arabic, Shalom quickly grasped the dialect of the Sufis' patois. Every night he was driven to a different part of the Negev to sleep. Burrowing into the ground, he would rest for a short while, never more than dozing, then move to another place to avoid the instructors he knew were hunting him. Discovery would almost certainly mean his mission would be either postponed for further training or assigned to another katza. Shalom had escaped detection. On the evening of November 25, 1990, he had boarded a CH-536 Sikorsky helicopter of the Israel Defense Forces Central Regional Command. Its crew had also been separately trained for the mission. In another area of the Negev base, they had practiced low-level weaving through an aerial obstacle course in the dark. Turbines had blasted the chopper with sand so that they could improve their techniques for flying through the unstable air currents of the Iraqi desert. The pilot had continuously stayed as close to the ground as he could without crashing. In another exercise, instructors had straddled the landing struts, firing weapons at target silhouettes while the pilot kept his machine steady. In between, the crew had studied their flight path. Only their commanding officer, Major General Danny Yatom, knew the route they would fly to the border with Iraq. Yatom had been a member of the elite Sayeret Matkal, commando unit, Israel's Green Berets, who in 1972 had successfully stormed a hijacked Belgium airliner at Tel Aviv Airport. Other commandos in the operation included Benjamin Netanyahu. The friendship with Israel's future prime minister would lead to Yatom later being given command of Mossad, a position that would also end his relationship with Netanyahu. But that was all in the future. On that December morning, while Shalom continued to peer out over the rim of the Wadi, he had no inkling that the long and dangerous journey that had brought him deep into hostile territory had been decided in a conference room in the Kiryah, the Israel Defense Forces headquarters in Tel Aviv. As well as Yatom, present had been Amnon Shachak, the head of Amman, military intelligence, and Shabtai Shavit. They had convened to discuss the latest information from a deep penetration informer inside Iran's terrorist network in Europe. The person, only Shavit knew if the informer was a man or a woman, was known by the letter I. All that Shachak and Yatom would have deduced was that the informer must have access to the fortified complex on the third floor of the Iranian embassy in Bonn, Germany. The complex contained six offices and a communications room. The entire area had been reinforced to withstand a bomb blast, and it was permanently manned by 20 Revolutionary Guards whose task it was to coordinate Iran's terrorist activities in Western Europe. They had recently tried to ship a ton of Semtex and electronic detonators out of Lebanon into Spain. The shipment was to replace explosives for a number of pro-Iranian terrorist groups in European countries. On a tip-off from Mossad, Spanish customs had boarded the ship as it sailed into territorial waters. But by the summer of 1990, Iran was also providing through the Bonn embassy huge cash disbursements to increase the influence of Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism in Europe. The amounts involved were all the more surprising given that Iran had been economically crippled by its 8-year war with Iraq, which had ended in a ceasefire in 1988. But on that November day in the Kiryas guarded conference room, it was not a new threat from Iran that the double agent had discovered. It was one from Iraq. I had obtained a copy of a detailed Iraqi battle plan stolen by Iran's own secret intelligence service from Baghdad military headquarters, outlining how Scud missiles would be used to launch chemical and biological weapons against Iran, Kuwait, and Israel. Uppermost in the mind of each man in the conference room was one question: could the information be trusted? I had proven to be sound in all the previous data he had provided. But important though the information had been, it paled against what I had now sent. Yet was the battle plan part of a plot by Iranian intelligence to drive Israel into launching a preemptive strike against Iraq? Had I been unmasked, and was he being used by Iran? Trying to answer that question was also fraught with risk. It would need time to brief a Katzar to make contact with I. It might be weeks before that was possible. Bringing an informer out of deep cover was a slow and delicate process. And if I proved to have remained loyal, his safety could still have been jeopardized. Yet the consequences of acting on the Iraqi document without checking could be calamitous for Israel. A preemptive strike would certainly lead to an Iraqi retaliation and could destroy the coalition being laboriously cobbled together in Washington to drive Saddam out of Kuwait. Many of its Arab members were likely to support Iraq against Israel. In August 1990, Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, an action that became the precursor to the eventual Gulf War. Iraq's move against Kuwait had been a spectacular intelligence failure for all the West's services. Not one had anticipated it would happen. Mossad had tried to verify reports that Saddam had actually stockpiled chemical weapons at secret sites south of Baghdad, which would place the weapons well within range not only of Kuwait City, but also cities in Israel. Within Mossad, there remained doubt as to whether Iraq possessed the rockets needed to fire the warheads. The only way to discover the truth about stolen battle plans had been to send Shalom into Iraq. Skimming above the desert, his helicopter had flown across a strip of Jordan in the deep black of night. Coated with stealth paint, its engine noise muffled, the Sikorsky was virtually undetectable to even the most sophisticated Jordanian radars. Flying silent mode, so that its rotor blades made no sound, the helicopter had reached its dropping point at the Iraqi border. Shalom had disappeared into the night. Despite all his training, nothing had quite prepared him for that moment. He was on his own. To survive, he had to respect his surroundings. A desert was like no other place on earth for surprises. A sandstorm could appear in moments, changing the landscape, burying him alive. 3 days after leaving the helicopter, on that cold December dawn, Shalom lay prostrate on the Iraqi wadi. Beneath his hupta, he wore goggles. Their lenses gave the dark landscape a crepuscular definition. The only weapon Shalom carried was one the Sarami would expect to find on him, a hunting knife. He had been taught to kill with that in a number of ways. Whether he would bother to use it against his superior force, he did not know any more than whether he could turn it on himself, or simply commit suicide with the lethal pill he carried. Since Eli Cohen's torture and death, a Katzar operating in Iran, Iraq, Yemen, or Syria had been given the right to kill himself rather than fall into the hands of barbaric interrogators. Meanwhile, Shalom continued to watch and wait. The nomads in their camps, half a mile away, beyond the wadi, had begun to recite their first prayers of the day. Already the bark of their dogs carried faintly on the wind, but the animals would not venture beyond the camp until the sun was above the horizon. Behavioral patterns were among the first lessons Shalom had learned in desert survival. According to the information he had been given at his briefing, the convoy should appear between the encampment and the hills to the left. To an untutored eye, the track they would travel over was invisible. To Shalom, it was as clear as a well-signposted road. The tiny rumplings of sand were created by desert moles burrowing between vehicle tracks. The sun was high when the convoy finally appeared. A Scud missile launcher and its support vehicle was still about a half a mile away when it stopped. Shalom began to photograph and time what he saw. It took the Iraqi crew 15 minutes to launch the Scud. It rose in an arc and disappeared over the horizon. Minutes later, the convoy was moving at speed toward the hills. In a few minutes, that Scud could have hit Tel Aviv or any other Israeli city if the launch had not been a practice. Shalom then began the long journey back to Tel Aviv. 6 weeks later, on January 12, 1991, Shalom was among a joint team of Mossad and Amman intelligence officers who sat around the conference table at the United States Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, its staff called it JSOC, at Pope Air Force Base, Georgia. JSOC commanded the Green Berets and the SEALs and had maintained a close working relationship with Mossad. After Shalom had returned from Iraq, Shavit had informed General Earl Steiner, operations commander of JSOC, that Saddam was doing more than posturing. The hard-charging general had a folksy style and a salty language the Israelis liked. But in a war room, his Tennessee drawl swiftly gave way to shrewd decisions. As the nation's top commando, he knew the value of good intelligence, and his own experience of the Middle East had convinced him Mossad offered the best. Since Saddam's incursion into Kuwait, Steiner had regularly communicated with his Israeli contacts. Some of them went back to 1983, when as a newly promoted brigadier general, he had been secretly sent by the Pentagon to Beirut to report directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on how far the United States should become embroiled in the Lebanon War. Later, he had worked closely with Mossad during the Achille Lauro hijacking, swooping down with his Delta Force commandos on an Italian Air Force base in Sicily, where the hijackers had stopped over in an airliner on their way to freedom out of Egypt. Italian troops had stopped Steiner from capturing the hijackers, and there had nearly been a shootout. Thwarted, Steiner had flown in hot pursuit of the airliner in his own military transport, only abandoning the chase when both planes entered Rome's airspace and its air traffic controllers threatened to shoot down the Delta Force aircraft for air piracy. In 1989, Steiner had been the ground commander for the invasion of Panama and had been responsible for the swift capture of Manuel Noriega. Only the Joint Chiefs Chairman General Colin Powell and General Norman Schwarzkopf, in charge of the coalition forces, knew about Steiner's relationship with Mossad. While Schwarzkopf battled to create a defensive line along the Saudi border to deal with a thrust out of Kuwait by Iraqi forces, Steiner's intelligence officers were working closely with Mossad to form resistance movements inside to try to topple Saddam. When Major General Wayne Downing, commander of JSOC, called the meeting to order in the conference room, everyone knew that as the hours ticked by to the deadline for war set by the United Nations for Tuesday, January 15, 1991, the world was conducting a dialogue with the deaf in Baghdad. Saddam continued to welcome what he predicted would be the mother of all wars. Downing began by reminding his listeners that Washington still required Israel to remain out of the war. In return, there would be long-term political and economic benefits for doing so. The immediate response from the Israelis was to produce a set of Shalom's enlarged photographs of the Scud launch. Then came their questions. Supposing Saddam fitted a nuclear warhead to a Scud? On a December evening in 1988, Pan American Airways Flight 103 from London to New York exploded in the air over Lockerbie in Scotland. Within hours, staff at LAP were working the phones to their media contacts, urging them to publicize that here was incontrovertible proof that Libya, through its intelligence service, Jamahiriya, was culpable. The author of this book received a call making such a claim from an LAP source hours after the disaster. Sanctions were swiftly imposed by the West against the Gaddafi regime. The United States and Britain issued indictments against two Libyans, charging them with the destruction of the Pan Am flight. Gaddafi refused to hand over the men for trial. LAP next accused Syria and Iran of being co-plotters in the Lockerbie disaster. The case against the Damascus regime turned on no more than its well-known support for state-sponsored terrorism. With Iran, the accusation was more specific. Pan Am 103 had been destroyed as an act of revenge for the shooting down on July 3, 1988, by the USS Vincennes of an Iranian passenger plane in the Persian Gulf, killing 290 people. It had been a tragic error for which the United States had apologized. LAP then named the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine as having conspired to destroy the airliner. None of the journalists who widely published this story stopped to think why Libya, accused as the original perpetrator, would have needed to call for help from Syria or Iran, let alone a Palestinian group. According to one British intelligence source, LAP was on a roll. Lockerbie was the perfect opportunity to remind the world that there existed the terror network that LAP always liked to promote. Lockerbie didn't need that. In fact, putting too many names in the pot was actually counterproductive. We knew only the Libyans were responsible. However, there were facts which did not make Pan Am 103 such an open-and-shut case. The PBS investigative television program Frontline subsequently claimed to have solved the cause of the disaster. Pan Am 103 had begun its journey in Frankfurt, where U.S.-bound passengers from the Middle East transferred onto Flight 103. Among them were Gannon and his CIA team, who had traveled on an Air Malta flight to make the connection. Their baggage was similar to thousands of suitcases which passed through the hands of Frankfurt baggage handlers every day. One of them was in the pay of terrorists. Somewhere in the airport baggage bays, the handler had concealed a suitcase already containing the bomb. His instruction was to spot a matching suitcase coming off a connecting flight and substitute his suitcase, and then let it continue on into the hold of Pan Am 103. It was a plausible theory, but only one of many advanced to explain the bombing. Understandably desperate to show the destruction of Pan Am 103 had been an act of terrorism for which it could not be culpable, the airline's insurers hired a New York firm of private investigators called Interfor. The company had been founded in 1979 by an Israeli, Yuval Aviv, who had immigrated to the United States the previous year. Aviv claimed to be a former desk officer with Mossad, a claim the service would deny. Nevertheless, Aviv had satisfied the insurers he had the right connections to unearth the truth. When they received his report, they could only have been stunned. On May 25, 1986, posing as technicians employed by Aer Lingus, the Irish national airline, Amiran Nir, Israel's anti-terrorism advisor, and Oliver North flew from Tel Aviv to Tehran on an Israeli aircraft painted with Aer Lingus's distinctive shamrock logo. On board were 97 tow-guided missiles and a pallet of Hawk missile spare parts. Nir was traveling on a false U.S. passport. It had been provided by North. North, ever the evangelizing Christian, had somehow persuaded President Reagan to inscribe a Bible to be presented to Ayatollah Rafsanjani, a devout Muslim. He had also brought a chocolate cake and sets of cold pistols for their hosts. It was all reminiscent of the days when traders had bartered for land with the Indians on Manhattan. The first Mossad knew of the mission was when the aircraft entered Iranian airspace. Nahum Admoni's reaction was described as incandescent rage. Luckily, the Iranians simply ordered the visitors out and used the mission to score a massive propaganda coup against the United States. Reagan was furious. Nevertheless, Nir managed to remain in government and in service for another 10 months, until the sniping from within the intelligence community calling for his removal had grown to a relentless fusillade. In those months, the cases of Hindawi, Vanunu, and so on crossed his desk, but any contributions he offered on how matters should be handled were icily rejected by Mossad. No longer welcome in Washington and isolated in Tel Aviv, Nir resigned as the Prime Minister's counterterrorism expert in March 1987. By then, his marriage was in trouble and his circle of friends had shrunk. Ari Ben Menashe remained one of Nir's few remaining links with his past. On November 30th, Nir and Stanton turned up at a small Mexican airport, this time with another man. On the passenger manifest, he was listed as Pedro Espinosa Juntado. Whom he worked for would remain yet another mystery. Another would be why, when they came to enter their own names on the manifest, both Nir and Stanton used their real identities. If the pilot noticed the discrepancy between the name Nir had given to charter the Cessna, it passed without comment. The plane took off in good flying conditions. On board were the pilot, a co-pilot, and their three passengers. 100 miles into the flight, the Cessna suddenly developed engine trouble and moments later crashed, killing Nir and the pilot. Stanton was seriously injured, the co-pilot and Juntado less so. By the time the first rescuer, Pedro Cruchet, arrived on the scene, Juntado had disappeared, another of those figures never to be seen again. How exactly Khrushchev came to be the first on the scene was yet another twist. He claimed to work for NUCAL, but the company's plant was a considerable distance away. He could not explain why he had been so close to the crash site. Asked by police to prove his identity, he pleaded he had lost his ID at a bullfight. It turned out Khrushchev was an Argentinian living in Mexico illegally. By the time that had been established, he too had vanished. At the crash site, Khrushchev had recovered and identified Nia's body, and he accompanied Stanton to the hospital. Stanton told crash investigators, according to Israeli journalist Ran Edelist in 1997, "While injured and shocked, I saw Amiram Nir a few meters away, waving and saying in a normal voice, 'Everything will be okay. Help is on the way.'" Stanton was twice assured in the days following that Nir was alive. Nir's body was flown back to Israel for burial. For the next 4 years, Shabtai Shavit continued to run Mossad, making every effort to keep it out of the headlines and free of the attention of the media. Away from the public gaze, the old jockeying for power within the Israeli intelligence community had lost none of his energy. Politicians who still sat on the Oversight Subcommittee on Intelligence remembered how Shavit had bested them after the Gulf War. Shabtai Shavit chose to ignore the warning signs. Suddenly, on a pleasant spring morning in 1996, he was summoned to the office of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and told he was being replaced. Shavit made no attempt to argue. He had seen enough of Netanyahu to know that would be pointless. He had only asked one question: who was his successor? Netanyahu had replied, "Dani Yatom." The day of the Prussian had arrived for Mossad. Dawn was breaking on Thursday, January 16, 1998, when the government car pulled away from the white-painted house in an exclusive suburb close to the electrified fence marking the border between Israel and Jordan. In one of those twists of history which abound in Israel, the house stood on grounds where the spies of Gideon, the great Jewish warrior, had prepared their intelligence-gathering missions to enable the Israelis to defeat overwhelmingly superior forces. Now Dani Yatom was setting off to finalize an operation which could save his career. Beginning with a debacle on the streets of Amman in July 1997, when a Kidon team failed to assassinate the Hamas leader Khalid Meshal, the past 7 months had been, Yatom had told friends, like living on the edge of the block waiting for the axe to fall. His executioner-in-waiting was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Their once close friendship had soured. But on this cold February morning, Yatom knew his time was running out. That was why he needed the operation he had nurtured these past weeks to work. It would show the Prime Minister his spy master had not lost his skills. But none of this showed on Yatom's face. Despite all he had endured, he kept his emotions under lock and key. Seated in a corner of the back seat of the Peugeot, in repose, Yatom looked genuinely intimidating in black leather bomber jacket, open-neck shirt, and gray pants. It was how he usually dressed for work. Clothes had never interested him. His receding hair, steel-framed glasses, and thin lips went well with his nickname, the Prussian. He knew he still commanded by something close to fear. Beside him on the seat were the morning newspapers. For once, there had been no speculation about his future. The Peugeot made its swift way down through the hills toward Tel Aviv, the sun reflecting off the burnished bodywork, which the chauffeur polished morning and evening to mirror perfection. The Peugeot had bulletproof windows, armor-plated coachwork, and anti-mine flooring. Only the official car of the Prime Minister had similar protection. Benjamin Netanyahu had offered Yatom the post of Director General of Mossad within minutes of Shabtai Shavit's going. In Yatom's first weeks in office, he had spent at least one evening a week with the Prime Minister. They had sat over cold beers and olives and put the world to rights and remembered the times when Yatom had commanded Bibi in an IDF commando unit. Afterward, Netanyahu had gone on to become Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, and then during the Gulf War, a self-styled expert on international terrorism, even broadcasting with a gas mask over his face in case a scud should fall nearby. Yatom, for his part, had said how much he relished the role of the outsider who had been given the most important post in the country's intelligence community, the quintessential career soldier. He had served as military attaché to Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Yatom and Netanyahu had seemed inseparable until two embankments had left a seemingly unbridgeable gulf. There had been the bungled affair in Amman. The operation had been ordered by Netanyahu. When the attack had failed and Mossad had been caught in the spotlight of the world's media, the Prime Minister had blamed Yatom for the debacle. He had taken the criticism without flinching. Privately, he had told friends that Netanyahu had the courage of other people's convictions. A second, and in many ways a graver embarrassment, surfaced. In October 1997, a senior Mossad officer, Yehuda Gil, was discovered to have invented, for the past 20 years, top-secret reports from a non-existent agent in Damascus. Gil had drawn substantial sums from Mossad's slush fund to pay the man, pocketing the money for himself. The scam had only come to light when a Mossad analyst studying the agent's latest report that Syria was about to attack Israel had become suspicious. Gil had been confronted by Yatom and made a full confession. Netanyahu had pounced. In a stormy meeting in the Prime Minister's office, Yatom had been brutally questioned over the way he ran Mossad. Netanyahu had brushed aside the argument that Gil had successfully carried off his deception under four previous directors. Yatom should have known, Netanyahu had shouted. It was another foul-up. Staff in the Prime Minister's office could not recall such a dressing down. The details had been leaked to the media, causing further embarrassment to Yatom. Shortly before 6:30 a.m. on that Monday, February 16th, Yatom's Peugeot entered the parking lot in the basement of Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv, and he took the elevator to the fourth-floor conference room. Waiting there were two men and two women. Seated around a table, they had already paired off as couples, the role they would assume in Switzerland. Each was in his late 20s, suntanned, and superbly fit-looking. For the past few days, they had been up in the snow of northern Israel, brushing up on their skiing. The previous evening, they had been fully briefed on the mission and had selected their cover identities. The men were to pose as successful stock market traders, taking a short break from the trading floor with their girlfriends, but never quite able to put work behind them. That would explain the laptop computer one of them would carry. The laptop had been wired to provide the link between the concealed recorder to be installed in the apartment basement and the safe house. One couple were to monitor the recorder around the clock once it began working. The other pair were from the Kidon unit. Their job was to find the best means to kill Abdul Zain. They would travel unarmed to Switzerland. Their guns would be provided later by the Brussels office. On the conference table were the listening device and the recorder. Yatom inspected them, saying the gadgets were far more sophisticated than any he had seen before. His final briefing was short. The group had picked up their airline tickets and spent the next 24 hours in a Mossad safe house in the city. Next Tuesday morning, February 20th, they boarded El Al Flight 347 to Zurich, obediently arriving at Ben-Gurion Airport, as requested by the airline 2 hours before takeoff. They joined the lines of passengers, mostly Swiss nationals or Israelis, making their way through the security checks. There was no light from Zain's apartment. The persons who called themselves Solly Goldberg, Rachel Jacobson, and Ephraim Rubinstein walked quickly toward the glass door of the building. Rubinstein carried a roll of plastic, Goldberg the laptop, Jacobson a carrier bag containing the listening devices. Meantime, Leah Cohen and Matty Finkelstein had enthusiastically begun to act out their lookout role, pretending to be lovers. Across the street, an elderly woman who suffered from insomnia was once more unable to sleep. The police would later insist on referring to her as Madam X. From her bedroom window, she stared out at a strange sight. A man, Rubinstein, was draping plastic across the glass door to stop anyone's looking into the apartment block opposite. Behind the sheet, she could see two other figures. Out in the street, in a parked car, was another shadowy couple. Just as Danny Yatom had warned, what she saw was certainly improper. The woman called the police. At a little after 2 a.m., a BMW squad car arrived in the street, catching Cohen and Finkelstein in mid-embrace. They were ordered to remain in the car. Meantime, police backup had arrived, and the trio inside the lobby were asked to explain what they were doing. Goldberg and Jacobson said they had mistaken the building for one where friends lived, and Rubinstein insisted he was taking down, not putting up, the plastic. Matters then became farcical. Goldberg and Jacobson asked permission to go to their car and check the address of their friends. No policeman accompanied them. At the same moment, Rubinstein fell to the ground, appearing to have suffered a heart attack. All the policemen gathered around to help and summon medical assistance. No one moved to stop the two cars as they raced out of Wabersacker Straße into the frosty night. Shortly afterward, the cars stopped to transfer one couple into the other car. The foursome crossed the border into France in the small hours of the morning. The first step was for Yatom to call the officer at the Foreign Ministry. The officer telephoned the head of the Prime Minister's office, who informed Benjamin Netanyahu. He called Israel's ambassador to the European Community in Brussels, Ephraim Halevi. The English-born diplomat had spent nearly 30 years as a senior Mossad officer with responsibility for maintaining good relations with security services of foreign states which had diplomatic relations with Israel. He had also played an important role in patching up relations with Jordan after the bungled operation in Amman. "Fix this and you'll be my friend for life," Netanyahu was later quoted as saying to Halevi. The ambassador had consulted the file of facts he carried everywhere before deciding whom to call first. Jacob Kellerberger, a senior officer at the Swiss Foreign Ministry. Halevi was at his diplomatic best. There had been a regrettable incident involving Mossad. Yet no one had suggested that Mossad should not retain its role as Israel's secret eye on the world. Without its skills, Israel might well find itself defeated by its enemies in the next century. Iraq and Syria were all developing technology which needed to be closely monitored. In the beginning, the operational style of Mossad had been to do what must be done, but do it secretly. In one of his one-to-one meetings with a staffer, Halevi had said he would like to see the Israeli intelligence community become a united family once more, with Mossad the uncle no one talks about. Only time would tell whether that is an unsupportable dream or whether, as many observers fear, the further Mossad is from its last public humiliation, the closer it is to the next. Notes on sources. I have had access at a sufficiently high level within the Israeli intelligence community to have made this an authoritative account. As with my previous books, I came to the subject of Mossad with no baggage. I have used information its members provided in the way any writer does when dealing with an intelligence service. Checked it, checked it, checked it. Some 80 hours of taped recollections were made, including repeated interviews with persons connected directly or indirectly with Mossad. Others were with persons Mossad had tried to kill. They included Leila Khaled, who came to notoriety during the spate of aircraft hijackings by the PLO in the 1970s, and Mohammed Abbas, who masterminded the hijacking of the Achille Lauro, in which a crippled American Jewish passenger was hurled over the side of the cruise liner to his death. I met them in May 1996 in Gaza City, where they had been permitted to visit Israel as part of its rapprochement with the PLO. I also spoke to Yasser Arafat, himself once a prime target for Mossad assassination. I was introduced to the business of writing on intelligence matters in 1960, when I worked with Chapman Pincher, then Britain's foremost writer on the subject. We were both employed by the Daily Express in London. A number of our stories, notably the Burgess and Maclean debacle for British intelligence, helped to change the perception of how such matters should be reported. It is a position I have tried to maintain with such books as Journey into Madness, Pontiff, and Chaos Under Heaven. I have reported on the secret intelligence wars being waged against Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, areas in which Mossad remains directly involved. I've also written extensively on Mossad's relationship with the Vatican. My own contacts with the Holy See were useful in conducting further background interviews for this book. In 1989, I was in China at the height of the student unrest. Once more, I witnessed the machinations of intelligence agencies and detected the hand of Mossad over its concern that China's exporting of weapons to both Iran and Iraq could pose a serious threat to Israel. I went on to write about the role of Mossad in the Persian Gulf War and in the aftermath of Soviet communism. In August 1994, I received a call from Zvi Spielman. Spielman is something of a legend in Israel. He fought with distinction in its War of Independence and went on to create Israel's United Film Studios. He has produced a raft of films, many of them Hollywood co-productions. Spielman asked if I would write and present a documentary on Mossad. He assured me I would have a completely free hand, that the only restriction on the information I obtained would be the questions I asked to obtain it. The more I asked, the more I would learn. I discovered that apart from Viktor Ostrovsky's books and the work of Ari Ben Menashe, there was precious little to read about Mossad in the way of hard information. This was in marked contrast to the CIA, which has some 200 books devoted to its work. The British Secret Intelligence Service has close to 50, and similar numbers are in print for the KGB and the German and French intelligence agencies. But a check on their contents showed there were gaps in the secret wars they had waged. It became clear that Mossad could fill many of these. On trips to Israel, some on behalf of Britain's Channel 4, the process of interviewing was like any other. The time frame of the story my interviewees had to tell initially encompassed a strange period, somewhere between recent history and fading memory as we came to know each other, and as their accounts moved closer to the present time, they became more specific, better able to remember the minutiae, who said what, when, and where. It became clear that even those who had helped found Mossad had vivid recollections of a period which was part of their living history and which had never been recounted from their perspective. Most important, they could relate those earlier times to the present day. For example, when they identified Mossad's role in the closing days of the Shah of Iran, they translated it as the root of the current scourge of Islamic fundamentalism. When they revealed Mossad's involvement with South Africa, they were able to juxtapose it with that country's situation today. Time and again, they showed how the past was part of Israel's present, how Mossad had bridged the gap between then and now. They showed that legends attributed to Mossad paled into insignificance when placed against what really had happened. I remember Raphael Eitan chuckling and saying, "Almost every published fact about the capture of Eichmann is pure bullshit. I know, because I personally am the man who captured him." In many ways, Eitan and his colleagues turned myths into a compelling reality. They asked I should do no less. Listening to Eitan, his achievements seemed to be as inexhaustible as his energy. He had fought a great secret war, a man of energy and endless vision. All he asked was to live long enough to see the day when Israel would truly be at peace. I learned quickly that there were distinct and acrimonious camps among my interviewees. There were the Issa Harel people and the Meir Amit people, and the contempt each had for the other was undimmed by the years. I sensed there will never be a mellowing on either side. This led to an additional problem, weighing the emphasis to be put on their information. My interviewees are also in a race with time. Men like Meir Amit are in the twilight of their lives. It was to his credit that he was willing to endure lengthy interviews and repetitive questions. He granted his last one shortly after he had returned from Vietnam, where he had gone to learn firsthand about how the Viet Cong had often outsmarted U.S. intelligence in the Vietnam War. One of the most fascinating interviews was with Uri Sagi. He sat in Zvi Spielman's office and spoke candidly on such diverse subjects as the need for Israel to come to an accommodation with Syria, and the problem he sometimes had with tasking Mossad when he had been Israel's overall intelligence supremo. David Kimche rarely let down his guard, insisting on seeing all questions beforehand. Nevertheless, he did impart important insights regarding his personal attitude toward people and events. My enduring memory of him was watching him feed his dog while elegantly destroying the credibility of those who did not measure up to his own standards. Yaakov Cohen opened his home and his heart and mind to me. We sat for many hours in the kibbutz where he now lives, as he remembered what he had said and felt at the time. As an example, he alone could recall the fear and remorse he had experienced when killing his first man. His reaction was in marked contrast to Rafi Eitan's feelings about killing. Yoel Ben Porat had the mentality of the lawyer's lawyer, dealing only with the facts and slow to conjecture. In many cases, he was able to fill in gaps which had been left open by history. Reuven Merhav was a font of information about Mossad's position in the framework of Israeli politics. Among the Israeli journalists I spoke with, two need special mention. Alex Doron was ready to sound off about Israeli intelligence in a way that was candid and refreshing. His support was valuable. On the other hand, Ran Edelist, who had been engaged as a researcher by Channel 4 for the TV film I was to present on Mossad, often paced an office in Zvi Spielman's studio complex, insisting it would not be proper to give full details in many cases. At times he seemed more concerned with what should not be in the program than with what should. In some of the interviews he attended, he frequently interrupted interviewees to caution them to be careful. Thankfully, few took his advice. Independently of Ran Edelist, I met with other Israeli intelligence operatives who were able to be open on the understanding they would not be directly quoted. They invited me to their homes. I met their families and came to know something of their private lives. It was a reminder that spies do not live in one dimension. I still remember completing a long interview with a former Katzar who provided an account of how he had killed. Suddenly he looked around at the comfortable living room with its views of a biblical landscape and sighed deeply and said, "This world is not this world." The words have stayed with me. I think that what he meant was that compared to his former work, beneath ordinary rhythms and appearances of life, a darkness and menace had never left him. I found that with several of the others with whom I spoke. It was a sobering reminder that the world of intelligence is, as St. Paul glimpsed heaven, all too often indeed, seen through a glass darkly.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.